Chapter 21. The Classical versus Keynesian Models of Income and Employment. Page 164. General Theory, Evolutionary or Revolutionary. The 1930s was the most turbulent decade that set off the most rapid advance in economic thought with the publication of Keynes' General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money in 1936. Keynes attacked the classical doctrine for its failure to solve the economic problems of the modern world. Around the turn of the present century, the world witnessed a series of crises which cast doubt on the practical utility of the orthodox economics. The Great Depression of the 30s demolished whatever faith was left of the self-regulating capitalist system. Thus, the general theory was born in a favorable environment and was characterized by economists like Harris as the new economics and by others as revolutionary or evolutionary. But as pointed out by Professor Harris, it is a matter of judgment whether the general theory is simply classical economics further developed or embroidered, or whether Keynesian economics represents a genuine break. Note 1. S. E. Harris, The New Economics, Keynes's Influence on Theory and Public Policy, 1947, page 55. There has been a public debate in the academic journals among the economists on the occasion of the 20th and the 25th anniversaries of the publication of the general theory, in fact right from its publication, as to whether it is evolutionary or revolutionary. No person is original in any pursuit of knowledge. He draws heavily from the ideas of the successive creative minds and formulates new ideas on their work and thought. Keynes also did the same thing. He accepted the classical theory, criticized and extended it, and at the same time rejected parts of it. The main elements of the general theory can be found in embryonic form in the works of his predecessors, but Keynes' novelty lies in giving them a new complexion. As rightly observed by Harris, out of the straws of his predecessors, with some additions of his own, he had built a structure which no economist or economic practitioner can afford not to inspect or use. No doubt the Keynesian economics is built on the classical economics, but it differs significantly from the latter in terms of assumptions, presentation of tools, of analysis and policy measures. In this sense, it is revolutionary rather than evolutionary. Keynes possessed great intuitive power and confidence, for he wrote to George Bernard Shaw in 1935, before the publication of his general theory. "You have to know that I believe myself to be writing a book on economic theory which will largely revolutionize, nor, I suppose at once, but in the course of the next 10 years, the way the world thinks about economic problem." Undoubtedly, the Keynesian analysis has significantly influenced matters of policy in the capitalist economics of the world. The following points mark Keynesian theory as revolutionary and a genuine departure from the classical economics. 1. Full employment. The classicist believed in the existence of full employment in the economy, and a situation of less than full employment was regarded as abnormal. They therefore never thought it necessary to have a special theory of employment. On the other hand, Keynes considered the existence of full employment in the economy as a special case. He put forth a general theory of employment applicable to every capitalist economy. His notion of underemployment equilibrium is indeed revolutionary and has stood the test of time. Page 165. 2. Say's Law. The classical analysis was based on Say's law of markets, that supply creates its own demand. The classicist thus ruled out the possibility of overproduction. Keynes's greatest achievement, according to Professor Sweezy, was the liberation of Anglo-American economics from this tyrannical dogma. Note 2. P.M. Sweezy, opposite, page 195. Keynes propounded the opposite view, that demand creates its own supply. Unemployment results from deficiency of effective demand because people do not spend the whole of their income on consumption. Thus, The development of the principles of effective demand and consumption function is a revolutionary contribution of Keynes to economic theory. To Klein, the revolution was solely the development of a theory of effective demand. Note 3. And to Hansen, consumption function is an epoch-making contribution to the tools of economic analysis. Note 3, L. R. Klein, opposite, page 56. Note 4, A. H. Hansen, A Guide to Keynes, 1953. 3. Laissez-faire. The classical economics was based on the laissez-faire policy of a self-adjusting economic system with no government intervention. Keynes discarded the policy of laissez-faire because he believed that enlightened self-interest did not always operate in the public interest, and it was this policy which led to the Great Depression. He therefore favored state intervention and stressed the importance of public investment to fill the gap created by the deficiency of private investment. Viewing Keynes's theory as a whole, its revolutionary nature lies, according to Professor Dillard, in the repudiation of any presumption in favor of laissez-faire. 4. Wage cut. Piaget, one of the foremost classical economists, favored the policy of wage cut to solve the problem of unemployment. But Keynes opposed such a policy both from the theoretical and practical points of view. Theoretically, a wage cut policy increases unemployment instead of removing it. Practically, workers are not prepared to accept a cut in money wage. Keynes therefore favored a flexible monetary policy to a flexible wage policy to raise the level of employment in the economy. Professor Harris regards Keynes's view on wages and employment as revolutionary. 5. Saving. The classicist emphasized the importance of saving or thrift in capital formation for economic growth. To Keynes, saving was a private virtue and a public vice. Increase in aggregate saving leads to a decline in aggregate consumption and demand, thereby decreasing the level of employment in the economy. Keynes thus advocated public spending instead of public saving to remove unemployment. He thus smashed the last pillar of the bourgeois' argument that unequal income led to increased saving and to capital formation for growth. This view might be termed revolutionary. 6. Saving, investment, equality. The classicist believed that saving and investment were equal at the full employment level, and in case of any divergence, the equality was brought about by the mechanism of rate of interest. Keynes held that the level of saving depended upon the level of income and not on the rate of interest. Similarly, investment is determined not only by rate of interest but by the marginal efficiency of capital. 7. Trade cycles. The classical economists failed to provide an adequate explanation of the cyclical phenomena. They could not explain the turning points of the business cycle satisfactorily and generally referred to boom and depression. Keynes's real contribution to the business cycle analysis lies in his explanation of turning points of the cycle and in the change of attitude as to what should and should not be done by government to control the cycle. In this field, as opined by Mrs. Robinson, Keynesian revolution commands the field. 8. Monetary theory. The classicists artificially separated the monetary theory from the value theory. Keynes, on the other hand, integrated monetary theory and value theory. He also brought interest theory into the domain of monetary theory. He regarded the rate of interest as a purely monetary phenomenon. He emphasized the demand for money as an asset and separated it into transactions demand, precautionary demand, and speculative demand to explain the determination of the rate of interest in the short run. By integrating the value theory and monetary theory through the theory of output, Keynes made money non-neutral as opposed to the classical view of neutrality of money. 9. Macroanalysis. The classical economics was a microeconomic analysis which the orthodox economists tried to apply to the economy as a whole. Keynes, on the other hand, adopted the macro approach to economic problems. But the Keynesian revolution lies in its macro dynamic orientation of aggregate income, employment, output, consumption, demand, supply, saving, and investment. As rightly pointed out by Professor Hansen, the general theory has helped to make us think of economics in dynamic rather than in static terms. Page 166. 10. Saving Capitalism. Keynes's most significant contribution lies in saving capitalism from the catastrophe it had fallen in the 1930s. The pure, unadulterated capitalism of the classical ideology could not function because, as Keynes wrote, it is not intelligent, it is not beautiful, it is not just, it is not virtuous, and it does not deliver the goods. Keynes reformed capitalism by advocating the necessity of state intervention in order to increase aggregate demand and employment, and thus saved it from giving way to communism. And in this sense, observes Professor Galbraith, Keynes was pretty successful because it brought Marxism in the advanced countries to a halt. 11. Policies. The classical economists, being the votaries of Lysis Fiery policy, had no faith either in fiscal policy or monetary policy. They believed in the balanced budget policy. Keynes, on the other hand, stressed the importance of deficit budgets during deflation and surplus budgets during inflation, along with cheap money and dear money policies, respectively. He was thus a practical economist whose models clarify both inflationary and deflationary episodes, and prosperous and depressed economies. His policy measures have been adopted by almost all the capitalist economies of the world. Thus, in the words of Joan Robinson, the Keynesian revolution has destroyed the old soporific doctrines, and we are left in the uncomfortable situation of having to think for ourselves. We may conclude that the general theory is not evolutionary but is revolutionary in both economic thought and policy, and is a genuine departure from the classical thought. Criticisms of Keynesian theory. Despite the theoretical and practical significance of the Keynesian theory, it is necessary to examine its failures and weaknesses for a proper evaluation. Keynes, while providing indispensable tools of analysis, raised more questions than he answered. According to Professor Kurihara, Note 5. K. Kurihara edited Post-Keynesian Economics, 1945. Few would gainsay that Keynes opened up new vistas and new pathways to a whole generation of economists. But many would now consider his analysis less than adequate for meeting such special problems as cyclical forecasts and controls, persistent inflation, the maintenance of full employment, booms, secular growth, non-linear structural relations, and macro-functional distribution. These problems lie generally outside the scheme of the general theory. Besides, every bit of Keynesian analysis has been criticized, such as aggregate demand, aggregate supply, the consumption function, the investment function, the monetary theory, etc. We study some of the major criticisms below. 1. Aggregate demand. Keynes asserted that the level of employment depended upon the level of aggregate demand, which was in turn determined by the inactive consumption demand and active investment demand. And unemployment resulted from the lack of aggregate demand. According to Professor Schlesinger, the Keynesian theory of aggregate demand suffered from certain inherent defects which made his theory of employment unrealistic. He opines that overall demand is, of course, to some extent affected by relations on the supply side. Keynes' treatment of demand was therefore oversimple in that it neglected the possibility that the relative prices prevailing in the different sectors determine in part the total amount of outlays. 2. Aggregate supply. Professor Don Patinkin regards Keynes's treatment of aggregate supply function inadequate. The aggregate supply is regarded as stable during the short run. Moreover, the representation of the aggregate supply curve by the 45 degrees line in the Keynesian cross diagram conveys the meaning that demand creates its own supply. In other words, it implies that the aggregate supply is governed by aggregate demand. According to Patinkin, this line of reasoning is yet another fallacious byproduct of the usual Keynesian neglect of the supply side of the commodity market. 3. Effective demand. Economists have criticized Keynes's principle of effective demand for two reasons. First, for taking the aggregate supply to be stable as noted above. Second, for assuming a direct functional relationship between effective demand and the volume of employment. According to Hazlitt, the volume of employment is not a function of effective demand. Rather, it depends upon the interrelationship between wage rates, prices, and the supply of money. Page 167. For instance, it is possible to achieve full employment even when the effective demand is low, provided wage rates are so flexible that they could be adjusted quickly to the prices. Thus, the direct relationship between effective demand and the volume of employment is fallacious. According to Professor Burns, the determination of K's theory in terms of effective demand reflects a pleasant but dangerous illusion. 4. Consumption function. Keynes' consumption function, though regarded as an epoch-making contribution to the tools of economic analysis, yet it is not free from defects. The relationship does not run simply from current income to current consumption, as Keynes forged. Rather, it involves some complex average of past and expected income and consumption, as pointed out by Professor Ackley. According to Slitcher, the level of consumption is determined to a significant extent by conditions other than the level of real income, which Keynes neglects altogether. They are the wealth effect, technological change, education, expectations, attitudes towards assets, etc. 5. Investment function. Keynes has also been criticized for formulating the functional relationship between investment and the rate of interest. The influence of the rate of interest in determining the volume of investment is very uncertain. It was for this purpose that Keynes made his analysis more complicated by introducing the interrelationship between the rate of interest and the marginal efficiency of capital to determine the level of investment. Keynes erred in depending exclusively on the investment function and taking the consumption function to be stable in determining the volume of employment. It has been proved beyond doubt that raising the propensity to consume even during the short run has a salutary effect on the volume of employment. Further, Keynes neglected the relationship between capital stock and investment. Lastly, his theory of investment failed to consider the effect of investment on technological progress. According to Professor Slitcher, his theory of investment exaggerated the disposition to hold and gratuitously assumed that the economy possesses only a meager capacity to discover or to create investment opportunities. Thus, Keynes ignores the impact of technology on the economy. 6. Rate of interest. The Keynesian theory of interest rate determination has been severely criticized by post-Keynesian economists. Keynes made the rate of interest determined by the demand for the supply of money. The demand for money arises from the transactions motive, the precautionary motive, and the speculative motive. Only the speculative demand for money is regarded interest elastic, whereas the transactions demand is considered interest inelastic. According to Hansen, Keynes believed, like the quantity theorists, that the transactions demand for money was interest inelastic. But he was wrong, because it is also interest elastic, though at high interest rates. Keynes's treatment of the speculative demand for money is very narrow because he confined himself only to cash and bonds and failed to consider other types of assets. There is money illusion in the Keynesian speculative demand for money, which means that the increased supply of money is absorbed only at a lower rate of interest. Moreover, Keynes ignored what Patinkin calls the direct influence of real balance effect on aggregate demand. When the wealth of the people increases, it affects consumption and hence the demand for money. Further, Keynes failed to consider the influence of price expectations on the demand for money. He assumed wages and prices to be given. Professor Friedman, in his Restatement of the Quantity of Money, considers the demand for money as dependent on the rate of change in the level of prices, among other factors. Under normal circumstances, the demand for money remains stable, but during hyperinflation, the demand for money falls due to the effects of price level expectations. Lastly, Keynes has also been criticized by Harrod for formulating his theory in stock terms and neglecting the flow variables. This weakness stems from his efforts to formulate a pure monetary theory of interest and his rejection of the Wechselian natural rate of interest. Thus, Keynes failed to incorporate the real forces determining the interest rate. As pointed out by Joan Robinson, Keynes's theory treated the rate of interest as determined by the demand and supply of money. This was a useful simplification in the pioneering days of the theory, but there is no such thing as rate of interest, and that the demand and supply of every type of asset has just much right to be considered as the demand and supply of money. Page 168. 7. Expectations. Keynes has been criticized for his overemphasis on expectations. Expectations breed uncertainty. Though Keynes gave a dominant role to expectations in influencing the marginal efficiency of capital, yet he failed to formulate a precise theory of expectations. He relied on convention for forecasting changes in business expectations and failed to confront ex ante and ex post reasoning, as Professor Hart puts it. The essence of this convention, according to Keynes, lies in assuming that the existing state of affairs will continue indefinitely, except in so far as we have specific reasons to expect a change. The reliance on the convention hypothesis makes Keynes's concept of expectations superfluous and unrealistic. 8. Saving and investment. Keynes did not pay as much importance to saving as to investment in his analysis. This stems from his weakness to relate saving as an ex post factor pertaining to the current period. It is ex ante saving that is more important in influencing the level of employment. Moreover, Keynes failed to recognize that saving is not hoarded but spent on both consumer and capital goods. Another weakness of the Keynesian analysis pertains to the relation between saving and investment. On the one hand, Keynes regarded saving and investment as merely different aspects of the same thing, and thus necessarily equal. On the other, they are regarded as two essentially different activities without even a nexus, so that they tended to equality only in equilibrium. Thus, Keynes makes the saving-investment relationship very confusing. 8. Wages. Economists have criticized the Keynesian analysis of wages and employment. The Keynesian underemployment equilibrium is based on wage rigidity. Keynes also suggested increase in money wages or reduction of real wages to remove unemployment. Patinkin has showed that underemployment equilibrium can exist even in a system of perfect competition and wage and price flexibility. Hazlitt holds that the market mechanism applies to the labor market. When money wages are very high, there will be unemployment on the principle that when the price of any commodity is very high, the whole of it will not be sold. Patinkin's argument is more convincing, that a deficiency in commodity demand can generate a decrease in labor input without requiring a priori increase in real wage rate. 10. Business cycles. Keynes has also been criticized for his analysis of business cycles, which was primarily based on expectations. Saulnier points out that Keynes' notes on the trade cycle lack in factual proof. In his words, Keynes makes no attempt to test any of his deductions with facts. Further, some of the variables of Keynes's business cycles, such as expectations, marginal efficiency of capital and investment, cannot explain the turning points of the business cycle. Keynes attributes the downturn to a sudden collapse in the marginal efficiency of capital. According to Hazlitt, the term marginal efficiency of capital being vague and ambiguous. Keynes's explanation of the crisis of the marginal efficiency of capital is either a useless truism or an obvious error. One of the serious omissions of Keynes's theory is the acceleration principle. This made his theory of business cycle one-sided because his explanation centers around the principle of multiplier. As pointed out by Hicks, the theory of the acceleration and the theory of multiplier are the two sides of the theory of the fluctuations, just as the theory of demand and the theory of supply are the two sides of the theory of value. 11. Dynamic theory. Keynes regarded his theory dynamic and called it the theory of shifting equilibrium. Even his foremost pupil, Roy Harrod, calls him the father of dynamic economics. Keynes introduced an element of dynamism in his theory through the expectations, but his analysis was concerned with the level of employment at any time. It is a lagless analysis. According to Professor Kurihara, the dynamic nature of Keynes's shifting equilibrium suggests that he is thinking dynamically, since there can be no shift from one position of equilibrium to another without prior movements of variables through time. Keynes made no attempt to show the process of transition from one position of equilibrium to another, however. His method of comparing different equilibrium levels of income has been termed comparative statics. Professor Ackley calls the Keynesian model as too static. 12. Short-run economics. Another criticism of the Keynesian economics is that it is applicable to the short run. Keynes himself remarked, "In the long run, we are all dead." He therefore assumed a given stock of capital equipment, existing technique, tastes and habits of the people, organization, size of population, etc. But all these factors change during the short run. This makes Keynes's analysis unrealistic. Moreover, economics is an incomplete study without concentrating on the long-run effects of these forces on the economy. Page 169. 13. Too aggregative. The Keynesian model has been criticized for being too aggregative. In other words, it lays too much emphasis on the macro aspect and utterly neglects the micro aspect. The use of the aggregative concept dooms the model to give wrong or misleading advice, in the opinion of Professor Ackley. The unit of analysis must be the individual commodity or commodities grouped in some other manner. Example, by degree of elasticity of supply. For a real understanding of the working of macroeconomic variables like income, investment, consumption, employment, etc., the study of their micro behavior is essential. Thus, the aggregative nature of Keynesian economics detracts from its utility as a realistic study of economic problems. 14. Closed economy. The Keynesian theory is based on the assumption of a closed economy, which excludes the impact of foreign trade on the level of employment and income. This makes Keynes's analysis unrealistic, because all economies are open economies and foreign trade has an important impact on their level of employment. For instance, an unfavorable balance of trade leads to the flow of income abroad, which results in the reduction of domestic income, investment, and the volume of employment via the reverse operation of the multiplier. On the contrary, a favorable balance of trade has the impact of increasing the level of income, investment, and employment in the economy. Thus, Keynes's neglect of the repercussions of foreign trade on the volume of employment is a serious defect in his theory. 15. Perfect competition. Another weakness of the Keynesian theory is that it is based on the unrealistic assumption of perfect competition. This makes his theory inapplicable to socialist or communist societies where the entire economy is regulated by the state. There is no cyclical unemployment in such economies. Hence, the question of the applicability of Keynesian theory in them does not arise. As Professor Harris remarked aptly, if communism comes, Keynes will be as dead as Ricardo. The Keynesian theory is not applicable even to modern capitalist economies where there is monopolistic competition rather than perfect competition. For instance, the principle of effective demand states that when the aggregate demand curve is over the aggregate supply curve, entrepreneurs employ more laborers in expectation of earning larger profits till the point of effective demand is reached. But it is not essential that the entrepreneurs must employ more workers if there is imperfect competition in order to reach equilibrium level of employment. Thus, the Keynesian theory is divorced from reality. 16. General theory. Keynes considered his theory as a general theory. But, as is clear from the above points, it is not a general theory but a special theory which is applicable only under static conditions in a perfectly competitive closed economy. Moreover, it fails to solve the problems of underdeveloped countries. The tools and assumptions on which the Keynesian economics is built are incapable of bringing the development to such economies. Thus, the Keynesian economics can by no means be termed as a general theory. Professor Harris is more realistic when he says, "Those who seek universal truths applicable in all places and at all times had better not waste their time on the general theory." 17. Problem of unemployment. Keynes has been criticized for tackling only cyclical unemployment and neglecting other types of unemployment to be found in capitalist economies. He did not offer any solution to frictional unemployment and technological unemployment. The problem of technological unemployment has been ignored by Keynes because he failed to visualize the rapid technological discoveries which took place in the advanced capitalist countries. Thus, the Keynesian economics is incomplete in solving the problems of unemployment. 18. Policy implications. The policy implications of Keynesian economics have also been criticized. Some of the criticisms are discussed below. A. To fight unemployment, Keynes recommended the policy of deficit spending. But this policy has serious repercussions because the state may spend beyond its means in an extravagant manner. Moreover, in America, deficit spending by the government led to inflation instead of raising the volume of employment. As Professor Hazlitt opines, inflation is at once an uncertain remedy for unemployment and unnecessary remedy for unemployment. To try to cure unemployment by inflation is to adjust the piano to the stool rather than the stool to the piano. Therefore, inflation or deficit spending cannot be relied upon to cure unemployment. B. Keynes favored public investment to overcome depression and to attain full employment. Though he said that the role of public investment was to supplement private investment and not to supplant it, yet public investment has tended to replace private investment to a large extent. With the nationalization of road, air and rail transport and a number of other industries and the starting of state enterprises, the sphere of public sector has expanded considerably. This has narrowed the sphere of private enterprise. Page 170. C. Keynes advocated progressive taxation to control inflationary trends in the economy. But higher taxes on companies may discourage private investment, and high commodity taxes may discourage consumption. This may have cumulative adverse effect on private investment and thus lead the economy towards recession. D. Keynes paid little attention to monetary policy. In the Keynesian system, money is neutral in situations of full employment and liquidity trap when the rate of interest becomes inelastic in a depression. It is only in the intermediate situation between these two extremes that money is non-neutral. This is a great weakness in the Keynesian analysis because monetary policy plays an important role even during these extreme situations, as has been proved by Friedman, Metzler, Patinkin and others. E. Keynes's policy measures fail to tackle the problems of capital formation and growth which result from technological innovations. They are also incapable of solving the problems of underdeveloped countries. In fact, the application of Keynesian policy measures to such economies have created more problems instead of solving them. F. Lastly, the Keynesian economics fail to provide solutions to a number of socio-economic problems facing the developed countries. Such problems include fair employment, income distribution, and resource allocation. This is a serious weakness in Keynesian policy measures. Conclusion. The critical evaluation of Keynesian economics reveals that there are Keynesians who eulogize Keynes, and there are the anti-Keynesians like Hazlitt who could not find a single doctrine that was both true and original. On the other hand, Keynes's greatest follower, Dillard, writes, "Keynes was an original thinker in the sense that he arrived at his ideas in his own way. The ideas he advanced were his own, even though someone else may have expounded the same or similar ideas at an early age." Though the problems of today are somewhat different from what they were when Keynes wrote his general theory, yet most economists approach the present-day problems within the framework of the Keynesian analysis. Despite Samuelson's severe denunciation of the general theory as a badly written book, poorly organized, not well suited for classroom use, arrogant, bad-tempered, polemical, not overly generous in its acknowledgments, and abounding in meads and confusions, it still remains the most popular treatise on economics whose technical apparatus has been absorbed into the general body of economics. There is hardly any book on macroeconomics, monetary economics, and public economics which is without the imprint of Keynesian thought and policy. Professor Harry Johnson wrote in 1961, "At this date, there is no need to labor the point that the general theory deserves much of the credit for the fact that the maintenance of high and stable government is now accepted as a governmental responsibility, or that Keynes's theory of effective demand is the origin of the modern theory of economic policy." According to Dillard, the acceptance of deficit financing as a respectable type of public policy is one of the remarkable changes in public thinking for which Keynesian economics has been primarily responsible. We therefore do not agree with Hazlitt, the staunch anti-Keynesian, that the general theory was one of the great intellectual scandals of our age. In fact, Schumpeter's assessment of Malthus applies fairly to Keynes. Keynes had the good fortune, for this is good fortune, to be the subject of equally unreasonable contradictory appraisals. He was a benefactor of humanity. He was a fiend. He was a profound thinker. He was a dunce. The man whose work stirred people's mind so as to elicit such passionate appraises was ipse facto no mediocrity. Rather, he was a genius. Page 171. Selected readings. Robert Lekerman edited Keynes's General Theory, Report of Three Decades, 1964. N. Marshall edited Keynes's Updated or Outdated, 1970. S. E. Harris edited The New Economics, Keynes's Influence on Theory and Public Policy, 1947. Exercises. Question 1. The general theory is simply classical economics further developed or embroidered by Keynes. Discuss. Question 2. Evaluate the Keynesian theory of income and employment. 3. Discuss the theoretical and practical significance of Keynesian theory of employment. 4. Discuss Keynes's influence on economic thought and policy. 5. Compare the classical and Keynesian models of income determination and point out the fundamental differences between the two. With this, we come to the end of chapter 21.